Hey, good to see you again, man.
Joseph, right?
Good to see you again, Joseph.
Hey, Caleb, how you doing, man? Awesome. How's everyone doing this morning? Did anyone stay up all night? You did. Anyone else? Only one person. I'm so impressed. That's incredible. How are you feeling this morning? Are you tired? No. Are you a coffee drinker? That's crazy. That's awesome. That's so much energy. If I don't get 7 hours or 6 hours, I'm just a mess. But you can do it no problem, eh? Incredible. What's your name? Mila. That's awesome, Mila. Sorry? Violet. Can we give it a round of applause for Violet? She stayed up all night long. Bet you weren't expecting that this morning. Yeah, let's see if you can make it all day. We'll see. Okay, hey, everyone. One more round of applause for the amazing worship team and everyone that helped coordinate today. Absolutely, absolutely incredible. Who is, raise your hand if you're participating in the talent contest today. Come on. What's your talent, bro? Yeah. Comedy act. Bro, I'm so pumped for that. You're going to as well? What are you going to do?
I'm going to be singing.
Singing? My man. What are you going to do?
I'm sing or beatbox.
Sing or beatbox? I hope you do a little bit of both, man. That'd be awesome. And someone raise their hand in the back. Is that you? What are you going to do? You don't know. You just want to participate.
Yeah.
I appreciate that enthusiasm. Yeah, that passion. That's awesome. What about you? What are you going to do? What are you guys going to sing? Reckless Love. Come on, somebody. That is going to be fantastic. Well, sorry? It's a high song? Well, I believe in you guys. Okay. What we're going to do today... And I realize I didn't tell you guys a little bit about my story. And I'm going to try, well, I don't want to, because I have something here that is really going to help you in your own thinking about faith today. I won't take too much time, but just to kind of give you a background of who I am a little bit more than just being an entrepreneur and from Oxford and living in Toronto and all of those sorts of things, I'll give you a little bit about my story. I didn't grow up in a Christian home, so I don't know how many of you guys didn't grow up in a Christian home. Maybe your parents converted or something like that. Now you have a Christian home, but I didn't come from a home like that. I came from they call it like a casual Catholic home. So what that means is like we would go to church on Christmas and Easter, those sorts of things, but it was more like fire insurance than anything else, right? So it was just in case there was a God, he'd be less ticked off at us if we put in a little bit of time at least with God. And so that was kind of my upbringing, but I didn't understand who Jesus was or the cross or anything like that. And then at 12 years old, that's when I started doing drugs. My parents, they had this awful, awful divorce. And I started using, so I started like smoking weed and started drinking and started smoking cigarettes and stuff and did all that kind of thing. And then that just grew into an opiate addiction just after high school. Do you guys know what opiates are? Yeah, most of us do. It's like Oxycontins, Percocets, morphine. It's like a synthetic heroin sort of thing. So you take these pills and they're like painkillers. And so what I was trying to do with all my drug use was trying to just kind of cope with life and find my equilibrium. And eventually, one day, my sister got saved. She got saved in this Cineplex. And that's where my home church used to do church, was in the Cineplex. You know what I mean by Cineplex? A movie theater? And which was awesome, thank you. And we did that, and it was my sister who invited my brother and I to come and listen. And I was like, heck no, I'm not going to go and listen. But actually, I didn't say heck no. I said this other four-letter word that starts with an F, and I can't say it in this holy ground of what I said. But if I did say it, you would have to forgive me because most of you guys are Christians. And so I said that sort of thing to my sister, and I was like, no, why would I go there? And that sort of thing. And it's a long story, but that's when I first heard about Jesus for the very first time, and it rocked my world. And it was only a few Sundays after that I started to put my faith in Jesus. And he radically changed my life for the better. My life was in the gutter at that point until Jesus came into my life. And once I got my life in alignment with who Jesus was, man, I started reading the Bible, and the Bible rocked my world. And that's what we're going to talk about today, is the Bible, and specifically the New Testament. And I'm going to tell you guys why I think the Bible is a trustworthy book, that you can trust the Bible. And I think we're going to have a PowerPoint that's going to be coming on soon. But let's just get right into it. It's a popular belief that there is no good reasons, no good evidence for believing that the Bible can be trusted, that its contents are actually true and that its contexts are actually reliable. You guys have probably heard that before at school or online or whatever it might be. And so I'm going to share with you guys five things today. Five things very quickly. It's going to be shorter than yesterday and unfortunately no movies. And five significant facts about the New Testament that create a compelling case that is worth thinking about deeply. Does that make sense? So five things, five facts I'm going to share with you guys. And I've even made them all P's. That's an alliteration. And that's like, man, it took me a long time to think of this. So I hope you appreciate it. So it's palaces, papyrus, places, people, and power. And I'm going to explain what each of those are. Is that cool? Is everyone tracking with me so far? Excellent. Okay, so the very first one is palaces. What do I mean by palaces or kingdoms? What do I mean by that? As I said in our session together yesterday, that non-Christian and Christian scholars all agree that Jesus has made the biggest footprint in all of history. And the book that contains his life, his teachings, his miracles, his death on the cross, and his resurrection is the New Testament. And in it, we see the four biographies of Jesus, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Maybe you've read those. And this is a magnificent book. You got to think about this just for a second. Just like put your thinking cap on or whatever you do. Maybe you're thinking fitted or you're thinking snapback. It is a book that is so enduring, it is so strong and so influential on people, on civilizations, on whole communities and nations and countries, that it has literally seen the rising and the falling of entire kingdoms and nations. Brick and iron have come and gone, but the Bible has outlasted them all. The Bible has outlasted all of these different palaces, all of these different kingdoms and people groups. All of them have come and gone, but the Bible has remained. And I think that as we begin thinking about this subject, this is why I picked this as my very first point. If there is any piece of literature, if there's any book that has the power to endure that way, then you owe it to yourself. You owe it to yourself to see what it says. This book has shaped our culture, has shaped nations, has changed people's lives for over 2,000 years. Most people nowadays, when they write a book, it'll have a shelf life of maybe a decade or two, but before you know it, it's on some dusty shelf somewhere, and no one will ever read it again. But the Bible is in a class all on its own. And it has seen the comings and goings of kingdoms, and it has earned the dignity, I think, at least, of you checking it out. So that's my very first point. Number two is papyrus. Raise your hand if you've ever heard that word before, papyrus. Okay, quite a few of you guys. So some people have claimed that, and you've probably heard this before as well. Some people are like, you know what? I would trust the Bible, but the content, man, like it's just been changed over so many thousands of years. It's just been changed. So I can't trust this sort of thing. Well, we're going to look at that objection right now. So what do I mean by papyrus? Now, it's a pretty uncontroversial part of history that the Bible, it's first written on these things called papyrus or parchment. They're basically the same thing. I'll use them interchangeably. One is written on plants and the other one is on animal skin. And these ancient manuscripts, they're super precious that we have. If we have any evidence for the Bible, it's on these papyrus, these things, it is super precious evidence. And the reason for that is it's because it's organic. It's not like the paper that you have. Even your paper will eventually decompose, but this stuff can decompose even quicker. So any sort of evidence we have is super, super valuable to any scholars that are looking into these sorts of things. And there are scores of scholars that look into this very subject that we're looking at today. There are so many of them. And each piece of evidence, each piece, is a treasure and gift from history. Each piece. So what sort of evidence or manuscript evidence or papyrus evidence do we actually have? And now I had the privilege of sitting under a guy named Dr. John Dixon. He's from Australia, that sort of thing. That was an awful Australian accent. I'm sorry, I won't do that again. And he's from Macquarie University. He's a professor of ancient history. And he is probably one of the world authorities on this subject. And he's incredible. He loves Jesus and loves talking about this sort of thing. And he says this in one of his books: the New Testament is the best attested text of classical antiquity. There's a lot of big words. What does that mean? Well, it means that the most amount of evidence, that there's the most amount of evidence and therefore the most trustworthy for the Bible out of any other book from ancient times. Antiquity means that there are books that were written before the printing press in the 1500s. So out of all of these books that we have, this one has the most evidence out of all of these ancient books that we have. And this is from a world authority that says this. My next slide will show you that according to the most current academic studies, so this is like brand new scholarship, brand new, 2020, that the New Testament enjoys 23,986 pieces of manuscript evidence. Let me just repeat that for you one more time so it sinks in. 23,986 pieces of manuscript evidence. And historically speaking, they are extremely close to the time of the actual events. And I put up here for you, if we go to the next slide, there is a fragment. So they basically break these, like, these sections of evidence into three major parts. One part is going to be like an entire New Testament that's been preserved by itself. Or they'll have like a single book. So it'd be like a gospel or like a letter from Paul or a couple letters from Paul or something like that. And then there are fragments. And we have thousands and thousands of fragments like this. And this is one of the oldest fragments that we possess, that scholars possess. And I actually researched what the translation was. And I've seen fragments like this myself with my own eyes back in Oxford. And this one in particular, it says this. Now check this out. This is one of the oldest fragments, and it says this: a king I am. For this I have been born, and for this I come into the world, so that I would testify to the truth. Everyone who is of the truth hears my voice. Pilate said to him, "What is truth?" And this, having been said, again he went out to the Jews and said to them, "I find no fault in him." John 18:37-38. That is lit. That is incredible. That's one of the oldest pieces. Even if we just had this old fragment, we could know a ton about Jesus. We could know that we could place him in history, that he lived around the time of Pontius Pilate. We could know that he claimed to be the truth. We could know that he was executed by the Romans and the Jews. We could know so many things just from this one small, seemingly insignificant fragment And that's just one of the 23,986 pieces of evidence that we have. In other words, according to New Testament scholars, if you were to take all of this evidence and look at it, New Testament scholars, they think that there is a 99% accuracy with this text. What does that mean? So that means, like, let's say you had your phone right now and you were to download the app that I use. It's called YouVersion. Have you guys ever heard of YouVersion before? Yeah? And so if you were to download this book right now or buy it from Amazon and receive it in the mail and then let's say you went to Jerusalem and you went and you looked at one of these New Testaments that they have from back then. Or you could even do it with the Old Testament. They have this scroll called the Scroll of Isaiah, which is the complete roll of Isaiah, which predates the existence of Jesus, which makes sense because Isaiah lived before Jesus. And you could download this app or you can buy the book on Amazon. You could go to one of these museums and you could read them side by side and 99% of it will be word for word unchanged. Absolutely incredible. Absolutely incredible. So anyone that says it's been changed over time, false. You're going to hear it again and again. False. It has not been changed over time. And if you're wondering about that 1%, these are trivial differences. Out of the 138,000 words that are in the New Testament, 1,400 of them make up this 1%. And out of these 1,400 words, they're insignificant changes. So, for instance, in 1 John, it says, John writes, he's like, you know, I write this so that your joy might be complete. Well, some translations will say, we write this so that our joy might be complete. Doesn't make a difference. Doesn't make a difference at all. And it especially does not make a difference to the core message of who Jesus claimed to be and his death and his resurrection. Does that make sense so far? This is awesome stuff, I think. I like history and all that kind of stuff, so maybe that's just me. But I think that that's absolutely incredible. And you can even, like, you can compare this too with other people from history if you're still, like, questioning it. Raise your hand if you know a guy named Plato, if you've ever heard that name before. And not the guy from Goofy. Plato. You've heard of Plato before. Okay, so lots of us raised our hands. So he's this philosopher. He's what they call a classic philosopher. And he was from back in the day, just before Jesus' time. And lots of people trust his work. So they look at his work, and it's so trusted and so well respected that they make this stuff mandatory reading in university. So many of your classes, not all of them, in university, you'll have to read Plato. It's just like really foundational learning when it comes to a university education. But if you look at the stats and if you look at the evidence, there are less than 10 existing copies of the ancient manuscripts of Plato. Less than 10. And they date around 1,400 years after Plato actually lived. That fragment that we looked at before, that was written one generation after Jesus. It's dated around 125 AD. Plato, by contrast, the oldest ones we have are written something like 1,400 years after he lived, and everyone trusts it. The Bible is in a category all on its own. Nobody enjoys evidence like Christians do when it comes to the Bible. Nobody does. It's absolutely unique. And my question for lots of people that distrust it but would trust something like Plato is, you have this mountain of evidence for the Bible and this small molehill of evidence for Plato, and yet you trust one and not the other. And I think that's intellectually dishonest. Okay, are you guys still tracking with me so far? Is this cool? I'm trying to bring like all the highlight stuff. So this is like the highlight reel of the New Testament scholarship to make it as interesting and stuff as possible. And if you're still interested, I can recommend all sorts of books for you because I geek out on this kind of stuff. Okay. So the next one is places. Now, this is really, really fascinating. We're going to raise your hand if you like archaeology, like you watch National Geographic and Discovery Channel and stuff. Yeah, me too, fam. Like, I geek out on that on Instagram and all that kind of stuff. So, okay, so the content's been well preserved, yeah? Well, how do we know that its content is actually, like, reliable content? Like, maybe it was just content that was well preserved, but it's just false. Just false content that was well preserved for 2,000 years. And so let's tackle that objection right now. So according to modern archaeologists on the ground in Israel, raise your hand if you've ever been to Israel before. Anybody? Oh, one person. Okay, that makes one of us. I haven't gone. I was just curious if anyone else had gone. But archaeologists on the ground in Israel today in 2020, they say this, that they are literally discovering artifacts, quote, on a daily basis, end quote, which helps support the Bible's claims to record real and accurate history. Does that make sense? They're discovering things on a daily basis that show that the Bible is recording real things. This is by no means an easy thing to do. I don't know if you've ever tried to dig up something. I'm from Alberta. We have the Royal Tyrrell Museum. Raise your hand if you've ever been to the Royal Tyrrell Museum. Oh, sick. We got to talk about dinosaurs afterwards. So this is by no means an easy thing to do. So really quickly, why is this not an easy thing to do? Well, historians tell us that we know less than 1% of all of history that has happened. Less than 1% of all of history. Just to put it in perspective for you, we know lots about Jesus, yeah? But what about the Caesars that lived around Jesus' day? You know how much we know about them? Very little. And these guys ruled the known world. And we know that they were writing letters back, you know, between their generals and all that kind of stuff. The Caesar that lived in Jesus' day, we don't have anything from him. We know a lot about these guys from the Bible. And then we eventually catch up and we find some archaeological find. But there are people out there that rule the world that we have no idea besides like a headshot of what they looked at. We have no idea what they were writing. And so we know so little. So the fact that we know so much about Jesus is just miraculous in and of itself. So we know so little. And you know what makes archaeology even more difficult is that the city of Jerusalem, right after Jesus' death, around 66 AD, was devastated by this huge war. There was this group of Jewish rebels, and they were proper extra rebels. You know what I mean by extra, yeah? And these guys were, like, they'd call them zealous or whatever like that, but we would call them extra. And these guys went on, and they tried to take on the Romans. And the Romans, if they were good at one thing, they were good at murder. They crushed these guys, absolutely annihilated them, and devastated the city in the process. Just tore it down. They burned down the temple. They destroyed everything. So what makes archaeology really difficult? Well, when you burn down the city to ashes, that makes it hard to find things, doesn't it? Does that make sense? It makes it really difficult. So the fact that we're finding things is actually very miraculous. Not to mention that there's a whole densely populated city that was built on top of it. If you go to Jerusalem right now, it's not like there no one lives there. There's lots of people that live there right now. And they built right on top. So it makes finding stuff really, really difficult. But the fact that we're finding things is incredible. There's this New Testament scholar, his name is Craig Evans, and he says this: if archaeologists and historians could not find connections between archaeology and the biblical text, there would be no such thing as biblical archaeology. But of course, they do find such connections, and lots of them. So what are some of the highlights for you? And I brought you guys some of my favorite highlights from this archaeology, and I think we have a slide for it next. Yeah, awesome. So these are five that are just like really, really popular to look at, and they're really, really convincing. There's an inscription with Pilate's name on it. There's the pool of Bethsaida. We'll talk about that in a minute. There's the pool of Siloam. There's Nazareth. There's these early church that this has actually been within the last couple of years that they found this early church. And it says on it, in honor of God, Jesus Christ. So the very first Christians, they all knew that Jesus claimed to be God. And that's what it says on their church. It's very fascinating. And there are so many other things as well. And these discoveries are absolutely fascinating. And I'll tell you why. So here's the pool of Bethsaida. Raise your hand if you've ever read about that before. Pool of Bethsaida. It's in John chapter 5. If you've ever read a gospel before, it's in John chapter 5. And this is really important. And I'll tell you why. So lots of scholars back in the day, they would say, you know what? Your Bible, it's pure rubbish. It's pure rubbish. When it's talking about things like the Pool of Bethsaida. Well, we went to Jerusalem and we can't find a Pool of Bethsaida. So we know that this is rubbish. We know that this isn't real. And they thought this for 19 centuries. They thought this until 1962 when they actually found it. So all of the time, archaeology is proving the Bible rather than disproving it. There's this other scholar, he's from Princeton University, another secondary kind of university. And I'm just kidding, it's pretty awesome. He writes, there are at least 9 significant archaeological discoveries which surround the core of the New Testament, which is Jesus' crucifixion. And they have all of these things. The steps to the temple itself, or like where it used to be, Pilate's inscription, Caiaphas's ossuary, Annas's tomb, crucified man's heel, ossuary of Simon of Cyrene. He's the guy that helped Jesus carry the cross. Golgotha, that's where Jesus was crucified, and a tomb with a rolling stone. All of those things seem to support this fact that what these guys are writing about, these places, are all true places. Does that make sense? Okay. Next is people. This is going to be really complex. So you really have to put your thinking snap back on when we're thinking about that. That's kind of like my contemporary 2020 take on the thinking cap. Thanks for the one guy that laughed. I appreciate it. Okay, so the people. So how can we know that? So we know that that each of this evidence, like, it's outlasted kingdoms. And then we know that the evidence is, like, there's lots of it. And then we know that the places that the Bible talks about, they're also true. But what about the people that they're talking about? So maybe Pilate makes sense, like we find him in history, but, like, what about all of the other characters? Can we know that what they're talking about is actually true as well? And so I'm going to try and summarize this really complex study that was recently done. There's this guy named Richard Bauckham, and he's one of these really, really astute, like really famous scholars for New Testament. And he did this study, and he did it like this. So him and this Israeli woman, she was a proper archaeologist, one of the leaders in the world for Israeli archaeology. And she goes and she looks at all of the tombs that are surrounding the ancient Jerusalem site. So these would have been all of the tombs that were present around Jesus' day. And she does this massive survey and says, like, what are all of the names that are on these tombs? And what are the most popular names for these tombs? And what she finds is that the most popular names for all of the dudes were Simon, John, and Ananias. For the girls, it was Mary, Martha, and Salome. Now, you have to really think about this. So she's going to the tombs, dusting them off, finding out what are the most popular names. These are the most popular names. Then she asks, well, why are these the most popular names? And the reason is there was lots of wars right before Jesus' time. And the Jews actually won one, which is a rare thing in their history. And they won one. And so these people that won and were afterwards put in power by the Jews. So these would have been like high priests and their wives and stuff. These people's names were used as names for babies. So, like, let's say it was like Simon was the high priest at that time. People would be like, oh, man, Simon, he's like the LeBron James of our culture. And so we're going to name our kid after Simon. Does that make sense? So there's like now there's like lots of Simons and he was married to Mary. So there's lots of Marys because we really love them and we really respect them. They're our all stars. Yeah. Does that make sense? And so they're looking at all of these things and they're like, and then this guy, Richard Bauckham, comes along and he's like, OK. What are the most so these are the most popular names. What are the most popular names in the New Testament? What are the most popular names in the New Testament? And he goes and does this search and finds out that the exact same names are the most popular names in history, are the most popular names in the New Testament. And they actually match up to the percent. Now, this is extraordinary, and I'll tell you why. Because the most popular names a generation afterwards, so like after St. Paul, were different because there was different people in power. And they were different before this generation because, well, there were different people in power. And there were different most popular names for the Jewish communities in Arabia or in Africa or any of these other places. So it's very, very specific to this particular region. So this is what they discovered. This boosted scholars' confidence that what the New Testament writers were writing about were actual people in history. Does that make sense? Like, this would be nearly impossible, to counterfeit. Like, they weren't even thinking that way. This is like 21st century research. They're not thinking about this 20 centuries ago. And certainly, it is highly improbable that anyone would have ever have thought, hey, we need to match up the most popular names to the percent. Does that make sense? Do we have the slide up there? Yeah. Absolutely phenomenal that we can trust that sort of thing. And if we can trust them with the little details like that, then we can trust them with the big details. And we know that we can trust them with the big details. I won't get into it, but there are over 9 sources outside of the Bible that all speak about the life and all of the events around Jesus's life. And scholars are really confident about these resources because these guys generally hated Christians. They'd call them a disease, they would call them evil, and all sorts of things. I think I have the 9 up there. Yeah. These guys would all write them off as some sort of weird cult. And so even though they were writing about Jesus, they would say he was a miracle worker and that he had this following and he was killed by the Jews and by the Romans and so on. We can say that all of these big details are also accurately recorded in history. Does that make sense? And then the very last one, you guys have been so great at listening this morning. I really appreciate it. The very last one, which is probably my favorite one, why I saved it for last, is power. And power to transform lives. Now, in my science talk yesterday, I talked about how the fact that the fact that there are millions of people around the globe that have had their lives changed from the impoverished people to the most successful people in the world have had their lives changed by the power of God. Absolutely changed beyond all recognition of what it used to be. For 2,000 years, this has taken place. And what you can do is you can look at each one of those lives as a case study, and you can say, now we have millions and millions of case studies which act as pieces of evidence to say that there is something real here. There is something here that we have to deeply think about when thinking about these sorts of things. That broken, hurting people reading their Bible have experienced God for themselves. And this sort of power, the power of a life change when they start reading their Bible and encountering God for themselves, is exactly what you would expect if the Bible is the Word of God. Does that make sense? That's exactly what you would expect to find if it is the Word of God. You would expect to find this power to change lives. I have a story for you guys, and it's one of my favorite stories from history. And it's by this girl. Her name is Fabiola. And there was this historian in the 300s that wrote about Fabiola. And you guys should know about her. She's like one of the heroes of Christendom, of Christianity. She's absolutely incredible. And Jerome, writing in the 300s, he would have been an eyewitness to her life. Fabiola, she wasn't always a Christian. She is a daughter of one of the 7 founding families of the Roman Empire. This means that she would have been wealthier and more powerful and prestigious beyond our comprehension. Like, her family helped rule the world. This is more than just being like the daughter of the president of the U.S. Like, this is of the world. You couldn't even imagine how wealthy and powerful this woman was. And so she actually got into this relationship with a man. They got married, and this man turned out to be a jerk. And because she was so well connected and so powerful and so wealthy, and the marriage was so awful, so abusive, that she was able to get a divorce, which was extraordinarily rare back then. And so she gets this divorce. And as she gets divorced, she's trying to really find herself. I don't know if you guys have ever seen a divorce happen. Maybe your parents are divorced. My parents are divorced. My wife's parents are divorced. And I don't know if there's anything that's more shattering to a family and a life than when you see your parents not love each other anymore. If that's you, man, my heart goes out to you. That really messed me up. And I totally understand if you feel a bit rattled by something like that. And all of us try and find our coping mechanism afterwards, right? So for me, it was drugs and drinking and partying, which I don't recommend. It just led to more pain. But Fabiola, she tries to cope somehow as well. And she tries to find some way of recovering from this awful marriage. And as she's trying to find her way, she comes across a group of Christians. And as she comes across this group of Christians, they tell her about Jesus. And that her life that feels meaningless can have meaning in it. And how she feels unloved, that the God of the universe loves her and died for her. And she feels loved again and like her life can matter. And all of these things. And she starts recovering. And then she has this heart not only to be loved by God, but to share that love with other people. And she is the one that starts the very first public hospital. The very first public hospital was started by a Christian woman. That's incredible. This is why you got to know this girl. She's absolutely astonishing. And Jerome writes this about her. And this is the thing I wanted to share with you guys. And then we'll get into Q&A time. Jerome says this about her. Fabiola broke up and sold all that she could lay her hands on of her property. And when she had turned it into money, she disposed of everything for the benefit of the poor. First of all, she founded an infirmary and gathered into it sufferers from the street, giving a nurse's care to poor bodies worn with sickness and hunger. Maimed noses, lost eyes, scorched feet, leprous arms, swollen bellies. How often she carried on her own shoulders poor filthy wretches tortured by epilepsy. How often did she wash away the pussy matter from their wounds, which others could not even endure to look at. She gave food with her own hands. And even when a man was but a breathing corpse, she would moisten their lips with drops of water. Listen now. And all of Rome was not large enough for her kindness. And all of Rome was not large enough for her kindness. This is a life that was transformed by the power of the gospel, of the Bible. And that's exactly the sort of power that we need in our world. And that's exactly the sort of power that you would expect to find if the Bible really is the Word of God. The Bible, I think, and many, many other people think, is indeed trustworthy. And that means that you can trust your life to Jesus, that you can trust in Him and hope in Him. And I'll end with this, probably the most beautiful words, I think, in all of the New Testament, and it's by Jesus Himself. Probably the most beautiful words in all of the New Testament, and it's by Jesus Himself. I'll finish with this. He says to you and to me, "Come unto me, all you who are weary and heavy burdened, and I will give you rest." Thanks so much for listening, guys. We'll end it there. Thank you for the timer that went off. Just kidding. Let's get into a time of Q&A.